My name is Nirina Kiplagat, and I'm the Regional Peacebuilding Advisor for UNDP in Africa. 5 years ago, we launched the groundbreaking Journey to Extremism report, a piece of primary research that shone light on the reasons people in Africa were turning to violent extremism. Since that time, the world has changed. COVID-19 has exacerbated many of the factors that pushed people towards violent extremism. In 2022, we will launch Journey to Extremism 2, shedding new light on the drivers, triggers, and contributors of violent extremism, drawing from primary data from Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Chad, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Sudan, as well as further exploring the exit routes and effectiveness of prevention programs. In the lead up to the launch of the main report, I am pleased to introduce a special 4-episode series of Exploring Extremism that unpacks some of the main findings from this research. This research aims to keep us abreast of the changing dynamics of violent extremism to better prevent and respond at both the policy level and in the practical implementation of prevention of violent extremism programs. Today, I will facilitate a discussion on patterns in child recruitment and retention of violent extremist groups in Africa and pathways for preventative efforts. On behalf of UNDP, I am pleased to welcome our civil society partners, Ms. Elwad Elman, Chief Operating Officer at Elman Peace and Human Rights Center, responsible for designing and overseeing the organization's programs, with a broad portfolio focused on human rights, gender justice, protection of civilians, peace building, and social entrepreneurship. As well as Dr. Abiye Iruya-Nema, Head of Psychology, Research and Policy at NEEM Foundation, facilitating mental health and psychosocial support and counseling services for communities in Nigeria. With a rich evidence-based data set, we are going to discuss the first policy brief on patterns in child recruitment and retention of violent extremist groups in Africa and pathways for preventative efforts as part of UNDP's series of thematically focused policy papers exploring key findings from the data in addition to the main report. The policy brief examines the patterns of child recruitment and retention in violent extremist groups and sheds light on perceptions around child recruitment and also experiences of the former recruits themselves. Many scholars have theorized that children are better able to evade detection, reach broader targets, easy to manipulate, and are cheaper to employ. Advancements in weapons and small arms has closed the efficacy gap between adults and children, meaning children are less expensive than adult combatants, but not necessarily less effective to perpetrate violence. Often, however, the motivations of armed groups may be more simple, like the need for domestic services, cooking, washing, and cleaning, which children are thought to be able to provide easily. I would therefore like to invite our partners with extensive expertise on reintegration of children associated with armed forces or armed groups, particularly in the context of Al-Shabaab in Somalia and Boko Haram in Nigeria, to share their insights on this topic. So to start off on the first question, if you could please elaborate on the main roles children have as part of the violent extremist groups in the Somalia Al-Shabaab context and Nigeria Boko Haram context. And in your answer, please do highlight any differences between recruitment and roles of girls and boys. Let's start with you, Elwad. Over to you.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Nirina, for having me on the podcast and for the opportunity to dive deeper into some of the very interesting findings that are already surfacing from the Journey to Extremist research undertaking that I had the opportunity to be a part of during the first iteration and now the second version. We've worked on children armed conflict issues in Somalia at the Elman Peace Center since the early 90s, And over the years, with evolving conflict and new factions, including the violent extremism phenomenon, we have been facilitating the disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of children co-opted, recruited, or forced into the ranks of groups like Al-Shabaab and their splinter factions. The data on grave rights violations aggregated over the past 5 years in Somalia indicate that Somalia is indeed now the most dangerous conflict on the planet for children, relative to other countries monitored by the UN through the monitoring and reporting mechanism. Somalia's total number of violations exceed more than 24,000. All other countries over the past 5 year period have been less than that number. Of the 6 violations that are reported by the MRM framework, Somalia has the highest number of abducted children and the second highest number of child recruitment cases. And what we've seen over the last 5 years in Somalia is that the recruitment rate has doubled by 300%. And I think this is really important for us to reflect on as well, too. The policy brief and the findings of the Journey to Extremism report indicate that child recruitment is not only a last resort by violent extremist groups, but that there is an intentional and deliberate focus on recruiting children. And this is also very important for practitioners and development actors when they're thinking about how to prevent further recruitment, that there's an intentional focus on the recruitment of children over adults. And so the role that we see of children in Somalia in their capacity within armed groups and violent extremist groups include that of foot soldiers or combatants. Children are serving in the roles of espionage for transporting weapons, including small and illicit arms, but are also used to transport improvised explosive device and detonate them as well too. Boys and girls are also used for domestic work. Girls often are forced into marriage with the intention of breeding more militants as well too. Boys are also affected by gender-based violence and they are also forced into marriage. And both boys and girls in Somalia are used as part of the community policing to enforce the laws in the areas that are controlled by these groups. We see that both boys and girls are indiscriminately recruited, often involuntarily by these armed groups, but their roles are still distinct and often embedded within the cultural norms and the gender norms within the community. Over.
Thank you very much, Ilward. And indeed, you know, a very startling statistic of the increase by 300%. I mean, this is definitely a topic that warrants a lot more attention. Over to you, Abiye.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak about these very pertinent issues. Although there are many commonalities in the way children are recruited into violent extremist groups and the roles that they play, there are also key differences between boys and girls. So I'm going to jump straight in to address your question on the roles that boys and girls play. Starting from the most horrific roles, although all roles are appalling, the role of girls, which can be broadly divided into kinetic and non-kinetic roles. For the kinetic roles, women, including girls as young as 7 years old, have been used as suicide bombers, owing in many ways to the freedom of movement in communities and public spaces. Nigeria, as it stands, has the highest record of female suicide bombers. For non-kinetic roles, girls are used as domestic help in various camps, with fighters forcibly marrying adolescent girls who provide the functions of a housewife. And often, these girls are passed from one fighter to another fighter after the fighter dies in battle, continuing the perpetual rape of these girls guised as holy matrimony. For boys, the same division applies. We can divide the roles, broadly speaking, into kinetic and non-kinetic roles. Where boys who play kinetic roles are actively engaged in the fighting, and boys who play non-kinetic roles are engaged in intelligence gathering as well as domestic work. And often, these boys engaged in the non-kinetic roles often progress to play kinetic roles. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Abiye. And I would like to now, you know, go into the issue of recruitment and particularly forced recruitment and engagement within these VE groups, which came out in both of your responses. The policy brief further depicts modes of child recruitment to violent extremist groups, including voluntary recruitment, forced conscription or kidnapping, and other coercive means such as threats or trafficking. The collected survey data shows that different groups relied on different tactics for child recruitment. Whilst the majority of current or former Boko Haram members stated that children were forcefully conscripted into the group, 39% agreeing, the majority of members of Al-Shabaab, by contrast, claim that children voluntarily joined the group. That was at 42%. With that background, whilst the question of voluntariness may be difficult to find objective answers to, could you please share with us which tactics and strategies violent extremist groups use in your context to sway and attract young boys and girls? And what factors make a child vulnerable to recruitment? So we'll start with Abiye on this one. Over to you.
Okay, thank you very much for that question. We have worked in several communities in the northeast of Nigeria affected by the Boko Haram violence insurgency. And we have worked with many families and many children, both individuals who remained in the communities, individuals who are currently in IDP camps, and individuals who left the camps and are reintegrated back into the communities. So I'm just going to run through a quick list of some of the recruitment processes that these violent extremists have used in various communities. In the early days, when Boko Haram first started, they would kidnap entire families, so both men, women, and children. In many instances, children have no choice when their parents joined. So you have a lot of men and women sometimes who became convinced to join Boko Haram in the communities and who left the communities to the Boko Haram camps. And so they'll usually go with their children who had no choice in the matter. Sometimes, in many instances, we had fighters who would come up from the camps and have children with local women in the communities. After these children had been born, they would take the children to the various camps and indoctrinate them to become violent extremists. When communities are attacked, sometimes men and women are killed and the children are left behind and taken to the camps. The terrorists are also known to pick up children on the streets. So children who sleep rough on the streets have been known to be picked up by Boko Haram and taken to the various camps. There are also many cases of extremist preaching and handing out of flyers in various local communities, especially during the very, very early days when Boko Haram started. There was also many reported cases where children have been offered money and the promise of guns once they join. There have also been several kidnappings, both in the communities and in schools, such as the kidnapping of the 276 schoolgirls in Chibok, which made headlines all over the world. This is not an isolated incident. There have been many, many such kidnap cases that have not really come to limelight. And also for girls, camps have female camp commanders called amiras. These amiras are also custodians, usually custodians of the children in the camp, and play a key role in recruiting children, mostly girls. Now, I'm going to quickly touch on some of the issues that make children vulnerable to recruitment in these local communities. One of the factors that's quite high up on top of the list is the socioeconomic standing of children in these communities. So the socioeconomic standing of the children and their families in the communities make them quite vulnerable. There's also the geographical scope. What we've seen over and over again is that these children are usually recruited around the communities that the conflict is active. So we don't usually see these violent extremists go to other far-flung communities to recruit children. It's usually done within the local environment. And so that makes the children quite vulnerable. The violent extremist groups, just like adults, offer children a sense of belonging. There's also a very important issues of lack of education and low quality of education, even when schools are available. This means that many of the children in many of these rural communities have no real concept of what the country is, have no real concept of what Nigeria is in the first place, or no real concept of boundaries, boundaries between Nigeria and the neighboring countries. And so it's very difficult for them to buy into that national identity that transcends ethnic differences. Also, in many of these communities, we still have quite a few preachers who were quite extremist in their preaching. And now a lot of these children are exposed to these extremist narratives. And even though these extremist narratives do not necessarily make them go to join Boko Haram, but it predisposes them, it makes them ready for when the Boko Haram recruiters come to the communities with the same type of extremist narratives. And we find that these children who already have been exposed to these extremist narratives and find it much easier to buy into Boko Haram as well as extremist narratives. So very quickly, there's just some key points I wanted to mention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Abiy, and really a lot of factors. I see us also moving towards where are the areas in terms of preventative efforts. On that note, Ilwad, over to you with the same question. Thank you.
Well, there are a lot of similarities between the situation and the recruitment patterns and vulnerabilities of children that Dr. Abiy just mentioned that could be reflective of the Somalia situation as well. Maybe I'll just zero in a bit more about the shockingly high number of children who mentioned that they joined voluntarily in Somalia in comparison to the other areas. And I think that this point also, calls for some reflection. How voluntary can the joining of these groups really, when the ideology is often communal, when these children are so young and their areas that they're joining these groups from have been under siege or under the control of these groups for their entire life? We see many young people joining groups like Al-Shabaab because they're at an age where they are expected by their family members to provide. It's part of the situation that they have been born into. This is the only governance structure they've seen. And for many, it is just getting a job with a recruiting body. So that's one factor to consider. We also see similarly that children that have the highest vulnerability are also intentionally recruited by these groups like Al-Shabaab and their splinter factions. We see that they offer a sense of community and belonging, and it isn't very difficult for these children to become a part of these movements because they've either been separated, unaccompanied, or orphaned. And this is one of the realities of also being in a protracted conflict when displacement is very high in the country. There's a lot of population movements and very little protection structures for children. What we've seen over the years, similar to the situation in Nigeria as well too, is that the vulnerability and recruitment patterns has evolved based on the situation. When the groups were newer, they used different tactics than they do today. We saw that at the beginning of Al-Shabaab, the beginning of the phenomenon, that there was a lot of voluntary participation, people that were bought into the ideology, including children that were romanticizing the movement and being infatuated by the power that it brought to being a part of groups like Al-Shabaab. But when they saw that they were often human shields, children being the first to be in the front line, not properly trained, parents themselves were not supporting them being part of the movement. And what we see now is that parents who refuse to let their sons be a part of groups like Al-Shabaab, they then are arrested, harassed, their livestock taken, forced to pay money is groups like Al-Shabaab and their splinter factions, ISIS in some parts of the country, forcefully recruiting children following the tribal breakdowns within Somalia. An entire community leader would be forced to bring a quota of children. So it's not uncommon for us to be receiving children that are all related because they were all recruited in one part. And often it's not contested by the parents because it's coming from an elder. And I think this is also something that has been a manifestation of past recruitment patterns not being viable anymore in the current situation.
Thank you very much, Ilward, and really bringing in an important point when we look at the issue of volunteerism and the context in which these children are born into, and also looking at the roles of elders, parents, the community. And as I mentioned, we're drawing closer towards, what does this all mean? How can these findings and analysis really contribute, towards preventative efforts of violent extremism? So drawing on your expertise and experience working in situations of protracted conflict with sustained recruitment by violent extremist groups, how best can child recruitment be prevented? And what can the development community do better in this regard? Over to you, Ilward.
Well, I think in both of the contributions from both Dr. Bia and I, we're seeing that preventing child recruitment alone can be the target from the international community. It needs to address the societal, developmental, security elements of the entire community. A holistic approach must be undertaken. And what we're seeing still in the responses to preventing the recruitment of children and even the facilitation of their reintegration is that it's still very short-sighted and short-term. The investment in reintegrating children needs to address the whole of society approach. And I think that as the community, the international community, looks at how to best protect children, they need to also recognize that these debates around the protection of children need to intersect with stabilization efforts, with reconciliation efforts. They need to have transitional justice aims as well too, and reestablishing protection structures within the community. And many reintegration efforts need to also have transitional justice aims. It needs to be focusing on the individual recovery of the child, but also much broader, targeting all of society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ilward. Abier?
Yes, thank you very much. I most definitely agree with Ilward. All the points that she has raised is very pertinent, not just to Somalia, not just to Nigeria, but most conflict zones in the global south. For prevention, I think we need to address the pull factors, the push and pull factors. There's not much that we can do concerning the pull factors, which are the factors that enticing the violent extremists offers such as a sense of belonging, money in communities, and so forth. What we can really, really address really effectively are the push factors in the community. And so there's push factors, not just for children, but for the parents as well. We need to address the socioeconomic vulnerabilities in these communities. We need not just more education, but better quality of education. We need more infrastructure in these communities. We need better healthcare in these communities. We need a safety net in these communities that families and children can know that there's a safety net when things go wrong. In many of these communities, it is not unheard of for people to die of preventable illnesses. It's not unheard of for people to die of illnesses that because they cannot afford medication, and $5 medication or $10 medication, and in really, really bad circumstances, medication of about a dollar or so. So these are really, really strong vulnerabilities and push factors in many of these communities. As Ilhod mentioned earlier on, that these violent extremists have had to change their strategies in many of these communities, especially as they became more and more violent. For instance, in Nigeria, when Boko Haram first started, they were in these communities providing this infrastructure. And in many of these rural communities, they were providing drinking water for communities. They were giving out loans to farmers and so forth. And so that's how they gained many, many recruits in many of these communities. It was only much later, years later, when they became much more violent, that families started to push back. Families started to push back on joining themselves and giving their children out to them and so forth. And so that's something that many of these community members want to see. They want to see development in the communities. They want to see a safety net for the most vulnerable members of the community. In addition to that, they also want to see the presence of government, the presence of government, not just in the capitals of states, not just in the big towns, but in the most rural areas, so they can feel part of the country and buy into the Nigerian project. In addition to that, we need proper regulation of preaching in many of these communities. And that's something which has not yet been done properly in this country. It needs to be more regulated with this fringe preachers and preach in the communities. As I mentioned earlier, the many, many fringe groups. So it's not just Boko Haram or ISWAP, the many other extremist preachers out there who were supposedly not affiliated with any of these groups, but they're still in the communities, in the rural areas, and preaching unchecked. So this needs to be checked as well. But going back to the first point, we need to address the push factors. It cannot be a piecemeal approach. It needs to be a holistic approach by both the humanitarian development and states and governments of particular countries. If we don't have this holistic approach, then whatever we do will not be very effective. Thank you.
I would add here as well too, just that in this report, we've been interviewing adults that are in rehabilitation programs, those that have been reintegrated back into the community. And this report also includes a specific focus on the patterns of recruitment of children. The international community still applies child-friendly versions of adult processes of children that have been recruited. And I think that what we need to do as a community of practice as well too, is move these processes that we've invested in quite extensively as a global community for a long time for adults, now develop different child-friendly and more specific processes to facilitate the reintegration of children by working with community-based actors, by working with community leaders that are the first responders often for children that are intentionally bypassing formal prosecution and screening processes. But this also links with prevention measures as well too. We need to think more creatively about how to reach out to children that have been co-opted or have been recruited by armed groups as well too. And they need to be targeted to children in Somalia. And it'd be great to hear from Dr. Ria as well too, but in Somalia, we hear that and we see the same approach to counter narratives, prevention of recruitment that are for adults, but now with just imagery and context for children being applied. And I believe that this is an area that the international community and the community of practice can do better to actually target children more effectively. From a civil society perspective, we work very closely with traditional leaders, religious elders, women and youth group that are within these communities that have unique influence to be able to reach out to children, to their mothers. And these are some of the avenues and pathways for communication that need to be exploited more for preventing recruitment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ilhod. Before we conclude, I do want to give Abiye just the last opportunity, if there are any last thoughts, and also from what Ilhod has shared, if you'd like to respond or add to that. Thank you.
Certainly, thank you very much. As Ilhod just mentioned as well, we have learned many lessons in the international community, both in the humanitarian sector and the development sector. And this needs to be pushed out to state governments. state governments need to take control and own these processes, because ultimately it all falls on them. A lot of the work that we're doing is piecemeal work in various communities, but we can't have a statewide approach or a nationwide approach. For this to be very effective, the state governments need to take ownership of those various approaches. And we've come a very long way. We've had years, we've had decades to refine these processes over and over again through various monitoring and evaluation processes, through various research and so forth. And we keep constantly defining and redefining these processes. So the state governments need to key into this and take ownership and scale it up across states and the entire country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Abir. And indeed, it is so important to have tailor-made approaches. And I mean, we often see this, you know, also in engagement of youth, which I think would apply also to children, of looking at them as a cohesive group instead of really seeing the differences and the importance of having these tailor-made approaches, gendered approaches for, you know, trying to mitigate child recruitment is really key. Indeed, the points are very well taken in terms of whole of society, holistic approaches. In consultations, what we've heard is, children problems, that the problems of the society problems, those are affecting the children. And so, you know, the point really is well taken in terms of having whole of society, holistic, inclusive, and looking at the different interventions, be it stabilization, humanitarian, and development responses in this regard. What we have discussed today is really a small snippet of the vast database we are currently analyzing. And we really hope to keep this conversation going. As mentioned, this is one of a series of thematic briefs.